Unseen Diversity, Lecture 10, Bacteria as Pathogens.
This lecture is about pathogens. It's a lecture that I have been leading up to for the last several lectures in this course, and that leading up has consisted mostly of only the most positive words that I can say about bacteria. There are perhaps millions of species or types of them. The vast majority of them have absolutely nothing to do with pathogenicity. We ourselves are carrying a huge load of bacteria as part of our normal microbiota. The pathogens are really a very exceptional topic. They tend to be the ones that get the press. They tend to be the ones that get the most focus in the media. But I want to present them in the context, in the much, much greater context of all of the rest of the bacteria. One of the questions that I ask about them is a reverse of maybe the usual way that people think about pathogens. I don't ask why there are so many, because there are not. I ask why there are so few. How can there be so few pathogens? Now, granted, some of these are horrific pathogens. And if I or a family member or a friend got them, I would be very concerned and I would want to immediately have the best medical attention possible. So I don't make light of the pathogens. But nevertheless, I ask why there are so few of them and what makes them so different. And I think this is a key to understanding them such that they might be controlled a little better. Asking that question in that particular way, seeing them as different, seeing them as anomalous, may be helpful in trying to get a better handle on how to control them. One way to think about it is bacteria and archaea have been evolving for 4 billion years. And some of those lineages go way back to a time when the Earth was much hotter. And we have Yellowstone, for example, Yellowstone National Park, as a modern-day example of an environment perhaps like that. We began evolving as a lineage, Homo sapiens, less than 1 million years ago. So one question is, what were those bacteria doing before we showed up? And showed up in the evolutionary sense. What were they doing? Well, they weren't doing anything pathogenic. And actually, one of the interesting characteristics of pathogens is that they tend to be relatively new in their relationships with us. And that newness sometimes results in dysfunctional relationships or unbalanced relationships, and therefore pathogenic relationships. I will say, however, though, for the most part, we are well defended against bacteria. Begins with our dry skin, and our skin is, for the most part, a dry surface. Here and there are, you know, dark, shadowy places where things are a little more moist, but for the most part, we have a dry, impenetrable skin surface, and even a shallow cut is not enough to get bacteria deep inside where they could do some serious harm. So for the most part, our dry skin is a protective surface. And remember, we also have bacteria on our skin, our own normal microbiota in those moist and darker places. And their presence there takes up space such that it's more difficult for bacteria that are less desirable to get into those places. Furthermore, we've got an immune system. We've got a wonderful, functional immune system that, for the most part, is vigilant against any sort of invading bacteria, viruses. And of course, there are exceptions, and the study of the immune system is a whole topic unto itself, so I'm not going to say much more about that, except to say that in our day-to-day interactions with bacteria, we are essentially well defended against them. Most of us are not sick of bacterial diseases. Most of us are healthy, and most of us are carrying around our correct microbiota of bacteria. So imagine this. What if we could look at the pathogens as though they each had their own trading card, like a baseball card? Maybe for each pathogen, there would be one card with the face of it having a picture of that pathogen and maybe a picture of what that pathogen might be up to in a human. And then on the reverse side, in tiny print, would be a whole list of statistics on that pathogen, exactly where it's found, how it might be cured, what the epidemiology is, who gets it, the consequences of that. And guess what? Those cards exist. And I want to tell you about them because I think they make a good mnemonic aid for thinking about and talking about the pathogens. Turns out that the American Society for Microbiology actually produces a set of microbe cards, is what they're called, pathogen trading cards. And I just happen to have a stack with me. And what's good about it, as far as a mnemonic aid goes, is that in that deck of cards, which, by the way, also includes virus pathogens and parasites, but also includes the bacteria number about 50. That is, the deck of cards that represents the pathogenic bacteria is about the size of an ordinary deck of cards. It's a great mnemonic aid. If you find yourself in a social situation in which pathogenic bacteria are being brought up, you can very easily recall that the trading cards for the pathogenic bacteria number about 50 and that it's the size of an ordinary pack of playing cards, as opposed to the millions of species or types of bacteria that are doing anything but something pathogenic. So, what do the cards tell us? Preparing for this lecture, I decided to set out all of the pathogen trading cards that I own. And again, not to make light of the subject, it may sound as though I'm not being respectful of them or sufficiently concerned about them. I am. But I'm not participating in the hysteria about them. I'm not participating in any of the frantic hysteria that sometimes gets generated by some industries that would like us to scrub up as though we were going into surgery every single day. So laying them out on the table, laying all these cards out, I found that 23 of the pathogen cards were for gram positives. And remember, we had the gram positives as part of our normal body bacteria. We saw them as a normal part of soil bacteria. They included the Firmicutes. They included the actinobacteria. They include many bacteria that are producing antibiotics. And some of the names, and I'm going to name these names because they might be familiar to you, are Streptococcus, Staphylococcus, Bacillus, and Clostridium. Notice that some of those names are ones that I've already named before as being a normal part of our microbiota. And this is one of the riddles of pathogens that I want to deal with. The riddle being that there are some pathogens that are opportunistic. They spend most of their time in a completely benign relationship with us, maybe even a beneficial relationship with us, and then under certain unusual circumstances, often recognizable circumstances, some of those bacteria can then be pathogenic for a time period. And that's an obligate pathogenicity. Also in the deck of cards are 26 proteobacteria. And recall that I talked about proteobacteria a few lectures back, especially highlighting some of the more charismatic ones. And I also mentioned a few of the proteobacteria in respect to there being our normal body bacteria when I talked about that microbiota. So that's about the entire deck of cards right there. In addition are a few bacteria that are called spirochetes, which are fascinating and which I'm going to linger on a little later, and a group of bacteria called the chlamydia that I will also linger on a little later. But those have relatively few cards in this deck. So the vast majority are gram-positives and proteobacteria. By the way, recall that when I described the National Database for Genome Sequences of Bacteria, which is a huge database growing every single day, that I said most of the sequences that are stored there are for gram-positives and for proteobacteria, but that this did not necessarily reflect that these are the most common bacteria on Earth. It rather represented that these are the bacteria that have received the most attention in laboratories because of their pathogenicities. They also, by the way, are among the bacteria that are easiest to grow in the laboratory because they like the same sorts of temperatures that we like. They like the same sort of nutrients that we like. In fact, they consider us, in some cases, to be a source of nutrients. And all of that is relatively easy to put together in a laboratory setting and to get them growing in the laboratory. So most of the sequences are of these organisms, but that by no means indicates that they are the most prevalent of bacteria. Okay, it's one of the illusions of the database at this point. So what I did next with my pathogen trading cards is I removed all the superficial, albeit unpleasant, bacteria. I'm not going to say anything's very nice about these, but these are the bacteria that are curable. These are the bacteria that are going to have a passing pathogenic relationship with you that will not be nice, but that you will survive, and you will survive it just fine. And you might actually be better later for it because you will have built up some small immunity to subsequent problems with these bacteria. So I'm not, again, making light of this. I don't enjoy getting some of these minor afflictions, but this is what many, many, many of the bacteria in the deck of cards are all about. Many of them give you diarrhea. And there you go. It's not pleasant, but you don't have it forever and ever. And it's for the most part not fatal. And what you do against diarrhea is fairly simple and fairly straightforward. Some of them will give you skin infections, including the sorts of erupting acne problems that occur at puberty. And those two are curable, controllable. You don't die of them. You move on from those. Some of them are involved in earaches, and those are the afflictions of young children very often, sometimes young enough children such that their nasal passages and their ear passages are still in development, and sometimes things are not juxtaposed such that bacteria don't get into the ear passages. And so that's why, you know, parents spend a great deal of time at doctor's offices with children suffering from earaches. That passes too. You don't have earaches for your entire life. And eventually that's something that you get by. Respiratory infections. Not pleasant. It's not good to get bacteria in your lungs. It's not good to be coughing up mucus of all sorts, but that too passes. These are, for the most part, curable. There's an exception, and let me linger for a moment on pneumonia. If you are coughing up and feeling great pain in your chest and suspect that you have pneumonia, which can be caused by a number of different organisms, including bacteria, it should be treated. That's a good example of something that is potentially fatal. You hear of people dying of pneumonia. And in fact, before the age of antibiotics, people would die of bacterial pneumonia. So I don't make light of that, but I would say that most of the respiratory infections that bacteria typically are involved with are few and far between, unpleasant, and curable. So I guess that's the good news. Now, what's the big exception to all of that? Well, if you are a patient in the hospital and you are already compromised in some other way, for example, having just had surgery, having perhaps received some drugs that compromise your immune system, having perhaps had a transplant of some sort, having some other very serious bacterial or viral infection that has altered your immune responses, then yes, you might be in some much greater trouble from some of these relatively simple bacteria. So that's another example of something that I don't want to make light of. I just mean people who are outside of the hospital and who have normal health usually have nothing much to fear from bacteria that have temporarily changed their relationship with us. So back to Streptococcus and Staphylococcus, also nicknamed strep and staph, which I mentioned as being part of our normal microbiota. These are some of the ones that can cause skin infections. These are some of the ones that can cause sore throats. And these are the ones that have this passing, potentially pathogenic, temporarily pathogenic relationship with us. So then I turn to the trading cards in the deck for the truly pathogenic bacteria, the ones that have a really dysfunctional relationship with ourselves. And I sorted them into a number of piles, just trying to understand what was the nature of that exceptionally dysfunctional relationship for these exceptional pathogens. And here's what I came up with. Two things. One is they have a tendency to be injected, which is a very unpleasant thought, but I'm afraid it's true. We're talking about fleas, we're talking about ticks, we're talking about mosquitoes and other sorts of biting arthropods, which we might encounter and which might be carrying these things and which can get them right past our dry skin barrier and right into our bloodstream. It's not a pleasant thought, but that's one of the characteristics that has come out in my sorting of these cards. And I will give you some specific examples in just a bit. Another characteristic that goes perhaps hand in hand with that injectability is that some of these have a tendency to not only get injected in or to find their way in some other method, but to get into our cells, which is pretty deep inside. That is, they're not just in our bloodstream. They're not just in amongst some tissue. They're not superficially there. They're far from superficial. They're actually inside of our cells. These are interesting bacteria. They often don't have any existence outside of that cellular existence inside of our cells. And that's kind of a scary thing. When you see a bacterium that doesn't have any free living existence at all and has only this task of being inside of our cells, that's a pathogen. That's a serious pathogen. And that's worthy of some scrutiny. So I will tell you about a couple of those as well. Here's another characteristic that came up when I was sorting through the pathogen trading cards. They're new. They're new to us, and that is part of the problem. And by new, I mean perhaps introduced into human populations tens of years ago, hundreds of years ago, maybe thousands of years ago, but all of that is relatively new on the scale of evolution. And therefore, we have not established, and they have not established, a smoother relationship yet with us. Maybe there's something that will happen thousands of years from now, but at this point, we're at a juncture where their relationship with us is dysfunctional, and they are using more resources, we being the resources. They're using more of our resources. They are out-competing our own cells. They are overgrowing wherever they manage to find a place in us and are essentially being destructive. So they're injectable, they're new, and sometimes they don't have any existence outside of our own bodies. Those are the characteristics of the truly pathogenic bacteria. So who are they? Well, here are some proteobacteria, some of which you've probably heard of. Remember, most of the proteobacteria are not in this category. These are the real exceptions. The first is a famous one, Yersinia pestis. It's the cause of bubonic plague. It is a very serious pathogen, and in fact, in the Middle Ages, it killed 1/4 of the population of Europe, as well as other populations in the world. I'm not going to go around, continent by continent, but it was a worldwide serious problem, especially since at that time it could be carried, you know, by people who were aboard a ship and heading out to some different place where they would carry the plague along with them. What was going on at that time? Well, there are whole books written on this, as there should be, because it was an extremely important event in the Middle Ages caused by this one little bacterium, Yersinia pestis. Rats and fleas were prevalent in the cities that were beginning to become more and more crowded, more and more congested, and the living conditions poorer and poorer in some of these cities or some of these sections of cities in medieval Europe. And so humans were having more and more contact with rats and fleas, and it turns out that Yersinia pestis is endemic in some rat populations. Notice that word endemic, contrast it with epidemic. So endemic implies that it's just a relatively normal, relatively symptomless part of the rat's microbiota. There may be some mild symptoms, but it's not something that was necessarily killing rats. Rats have fleas. The fleas were picking up the Yersinia pestis, and they were injecting it into us. Humans were being bitten by rat fleas. Very unpleasant thought. And so here's this brand new rat pathogenic bacterium arriving to us, and we don't have any sort of relationship with it at all, except for this extremely negative relationship that resulted in a great many deaths. So there's a great example of everything that I was saying characterizes a pathogen. Then there is Francisella tularensis, which causes a plague-like disease, and it too is endemic in a population, happens to be a population of rabbits. It is carried to us by deer ticks and flies that might be on the rabbits, and then they transfer and inject that into us. So again, there's a relatively new dysfunctional relationship that arrives to us via injection. Rickettsia. There are two rickettsias. These two are proteobacteria. And I mention them not because they're so common, although I'll give you the names of the diseases that a couple of them cause, but because they are also an example of bacteria that don't have any existence outside of their relationship with us. They get inside of our cells, and there's some interesting characteristics around that. One of the rickettsias causes Rocky Mountain spotted fever. The other rickettsia causes typhus. The first rickettsia, the Rocky Mountain spotted fever is carried by ticks. So here's another injectable bacterium. And typhus is carried by lice. Here's what's interesting about them. They have really tiny genomes. So if you were looking through the database at NCBI and looking at the genomes and getting to the place where the size of the genomes is indicated, these are among the smallest of genomes in that database. And what does that mean? It means that these are obligate parasites. It means that these bacteria are not easily grown out on petri dishes because most of their needs are taken care of by a complex host, such as ourselves. And when they get deep inside of our own cells, they lose many of their own genes that they don't need anymore because we're supplying the nutrients to them. We're supplying the protection. We're supplying all of their regular cell needs. They get greatly reduced genomes, far fewer genes. And this is one of the signs of a really serious pathogen in many cases. Ironically, it can also be the sign of a good relationship as well, in that there are probably many examples of bacteria as yet unstudied with greatly reduced genomes, which have been evolving with us for a long time, in which actually have a compatible relationship, in which our genes are complementing each other. But in the case of rickettsia, it's not a good situation. Now, on to the gram-positives. We have some really unpleasant gram-positives. Group called the mycobacteria, mycobacteria, and number of interesting things about them. You might recall that the gram-positives were inadvertently discovered by Dr. Christian Graham, who stained them blue with what later came to be called Graham stain. However, mycobacteria don't have any walls with which to retain Gram stain. They don't stain with Gram stain, so they're an exception. And it took a number of years for scientists to sort this out. Who were these mycobacteria? They look like Gram positives, but they're not acting like Gram positives. They don't take up this special stain. Well, part of the reason is because this is yet another example of bacteria who have lost much of their complexity because they have no outside existence, and in fact they dwell inside of our cells and inside of the cells of their hosts, no matter what those hosts might be. And two of the really unpleasant diseases that get caused by mycobacteria are leprosy and tuberculosis. Those are not necessarily injected. Those can be just simply passed around by either sputum that's being coughed up in the case of tuberculosis or contact in the case of leprosy. But you should also know that our immune system defends us against these. You could be working in a leper colony and not necessarily come up with leprosy, and there are, of course, many, many examples of that. And you could be in a city where, unfortunately, tuberculosis is still prevalent, and there are cities like that. and not necessarily come up with tuberculosis. So there are some good news about that as well, perhaps. Now, in addition to proteobacteria and in addition to gram-positives are a couple of other major groups that are in my deck of pathogen cards. There are the chlamydia, which are a group unto themselves, C-H-L-A-M-Y-D-I-A, and they too are obligate intracellular, inside the cell, pathogens without any particular existence outside of a host. I won't say much more about them. They're not necessarily among the really mainstream pathogens, but they certainly fall into the category of being having an obligate in often dysfunctional relationship with a host. What I want to go to now is a fascinating group of bacteria that have their own main branch on the big family tree of all the bacteria and archaea and are well worth studying in all of their different forms. And these are the spirochetes, one of my favorite groups of bacteria. And most of them are free living. The vast majority of them can be found out in the environment, doing whatever bacteria do out there, whatever particular function, or found in perfectly benign, even beneficial relationships with a host. So the vast majority of spirochetes are not pathogens, but they've got some characteristics that make it especially easy for those that are pathogens to do what they do. And here's where it gets a bit unpleasant. These are among the few bacteria that actually have a striking morphology. For the most part, I've been talking about very tiny, very simple cells with not much to speak of in respect to morphology. The choices are few. Little round things, little rod-shaped things, little squiggly things, that's about it. Spirochetes are different. Spirochetes have a wonderful morphology. They look like long, skinny worms, and they move about in a sort of a wonderful corkscrew kind of pattern. And it means that they can do what a corkscrew does. When you think of moving a corkscrew through the hard cork at the top of a bottle of wine, it gets through well because it spirals in. If you were trying to put something in straight and then pull it out as you do with a corkscrew, it would be less effective. Spirochetes corkscrew into very dense material. So out in the rest of the world, that means they corkscrew their way into thick muds and into thick sediments and into soils, moist soils, where they can get through very readily, almost like a corkscrew going through a cork. So it's a wonderful adaptation for them. Here are the two bad spirochetes that are in my deck of cards. Borrelia, B-O-R-R-E-L-I-A. And that is the causer of Lyme disease, terrible disease, carried by ticks. So here we've got the injectable aspect, carried by ticks to humans and to dogs in some cases. In this spirochete, Borrelia, not only gets injected, but then uses its ability to get deep into the body by corkscrewing its way in through the tissues. Very unpleasant thought. And there's an additional thing, too, which makes it especially difficult to cure and especially difficult for your immune system to defend against it, and that is it's got some very strange things going on with its DNA. If you go and look up Borrelia in the database at NCBI and see what's happening with its genome, you will see that in addition to its regular genome, it's got a large number of auxiliary small versions of genomes that it carries around that are extremely flexible and that allow it to change its disguise spontaneously such that it's almost like a Trojan horse in your bloodstream. Your immune system is looking for something that is foreign and it doesn't see anything that's foreign. It sees just Borrelia in its little disguise that it has managed to rig together by recombining its genes in all sorts of clever ways that are not even fully well understood. I just know that it's a serious problem and not one of my favorite bacteria, I will say that. On a personal note, my dog has had it. It's quite debilitating, and it's quite a process to cure a dog of it. And I know people that have had it. Perhaps you do, too. And it's very debilitating in people and a real challenge to cure. Another spirochete is treponema. It's the causer of syphilis. Now, that's passed venereally from person to person, so it's not injected, at least not by insects, and it's very invasive and can get all over the body, and imagine it corkscrewing everywhere. Now, there are two other pathogens that I want to discuss last in this lecture, and they really fall into their own category, and it's an unfortunate category. These are two antibiotic-resistant versions of bacteria that we typically carry with us naturally. They are especially virulent, especially antibiotic versions of E. coli, and especially virulent and especially antibiotic-resistant variations of Staphylococcus aureus, or Staph. So E. coli and Staph have rightly made the news in the last several years for reasons that are unfortunate. Their antibiotic resistance has really been in great part a consequence of misuse of antibiotics by ourselves. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that in the next lecture, exactly how that misuse has come about and what some of the consequences have been. E. coli and Staph aureus should not, in a normal situation, be so highly resistant. And it means, unfortunately, that if you were to get an infection with these very resistant forms, it might be difficult, even in a hospital setting, for your doctors to do much, even with antibiotics, to get you cured of them. The other interesting thing about E. coli, the especially resistant form, and Staph aureus, the especially resistant form, is that they're much more highly invasive than the usual E. coli and Staph aureus that we carry with us. Shockingly invasive, and therefore in some patients lethal or causing enormous damage and horrific damage. In the next lecture, I'm going to give you some circumstances in which both this type of E. coli and this type of Staphylococcus aureus come about and say something about how perhaps we could control it a little bit better and maybe put an end to this era that we're in of developing our own pathogens by our own particular uses of antibiotics. At this point, though, it's a serious problem. And if you look in the NCBI database for E. coli and Staphylococcus aureus, you will see that there are several strains for each of them. And one of the things that scientists are trying to do right now is to understand how the DNA in these various strains of E. coli differs and in what ways it's similar, and how the DNA of the various strains of Staphylococcus differ and in what way they're the same. So genome projects are underway to try to sort this out and to try to understand exactly what it is about these that makes them so virulent and so resistant to any treatment. So the next lecture will begin with antibiotic resistance and how that comes about. And then from there, I'm going to segue to something about viruses, because I would like at this point to put them into their proper perspective along with the pathogens that I've been talking about.
This ends Lecture 10. Remember to visit this course's website at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll find additional information about the lectures you just heard. Once there, you can access this course by using the password 1121BDD. Again, that's 1121BDD. If you borrow this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399, and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.